Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I meet with military veterans to learn about what they do in their civilian career and how they got there. Today's episode number 147 with Bill Angeloni.
And I think the amount of luck that it takes to have the experience that I have, I didn't appreciate it at the time, right? I mean, I just thought this is what happened. I mean, that was my first startup, and I got really lucky. But as time goes on and as I work with others, you realize that not too many do that. And obviously, you know, the venture capital world has figured out that like 90% of companies fail. It's just something that I think you need to go into eyes wide open.
Well, my guest today, Bill, has quite an eclectic background. He has done everything from working at United Airlines to working at a consulting company to starting his own consulting company to joining high growth startups to advising them and starting companies. He has done a lot of different things. And one of the reasons I think you would really enjoy this is he has a great perspective on networking. If you've listened to other Beyond the Uniform interviews, you realize how many of my guests found an opportunity through networking and how often veterans are off-put by networking. Bill does an exceptional job of talking about how a veteran can approach networking in a way that feels right for them. He also has a great perspective on how to find a job and join a high-growth startup, just like he did. And he talks about what it's like starting your own consulting company and other companies as well. I think you'll find it just an interesting perspective, too, at how you can have a lot of variety in your career. There's no one answer. There's no one path. And you don't need to get it right on your first time. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find other interviews just like this, show notes with references to everything we discussed, and a text transcript as well. And if you are liking the show, it would be great to receive a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps get the word out about the show. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with Bill. Joining me today in Sonoma, California is Bill Angeloni. Bill, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks, Justin. Great to be here.
So for listeners, I wanted to give you a very brief bio on Bill. He is the founder and director of Tenzing Consulting, which is a global management consulting firm he co-founded that now has over 850 experts and works with Fortune 1000 clients and private equity companies. He started out at the Naval Academy, after which he served as an officer in the Navy for 5 years while also earning his MBA from Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. After his time on active duty, he worked at United Airlines doing strategy and operation work, as well as a manager at A.T. Kearney and a global manager at Free Markets, Inc., which was a startup where he opened their European offices and helped grow to $200 million and then took public. After that, he co-founded his own management consulting firm, which he has co-led for 7 of the last 15 years. He took an 8-year leave of absence to lead a tech company turnaround and start a couple other companies. He has worked with over 30 startups over his career and thinks of himself as a startup junkie. So, Bill, maybe to start things off, there's always blind spots we have. And I'm just wondering, you know, most of the audience that you're speaking to is active duty listeners. What's one thing that they don't know about their upcoming or eventual transition to a civilian career?
You know, I think there's a lot of anxiety, obviously, in the transition to a civilian career, and certainly I had it. I think on a positive note, I think the best thing is that you don't realize how prepared you actually are. A lot of the skills that we develop in the military really help you in civilian career, and it's actually unique that you have these skills, things like a mission focus, the resilience to when something changes to adapt and keep going, you know, flexibility and a willingness or the ability to just, you know, change course as needed. And then leadership, you know, I think we forget that whether we've actually led people or been a follower of great leaders, you know, we have a good understanding of what good leadership looks like. You know, we all have the leaders that we love to follow, and we have those that we don't really care for. And I think having that insight as well as you get into the civilian community gives you kind of a leg up on a lot of other people.
That's great. And what was your first job search like? What led you to United Airlines?
So it was actually a pretty terrible experience. I got out of the Navy in 92 during a recession. And at the time, Kellogg wasn't allowing its part-time. I went part-time, obviously, because I was still in the Navy. They weren't allowing their part-time graduates to use their placement service. And so I basically leveraged my Naval Academy network and just started making phone calls and talking to people about what was out there, what my interests were, and that led me to a gentleman that was at United that knew that they were, for the first time, actually hiring MBAs. And I ended up talking to them and getting an offer to join them. And it was the only offer that I had at the time. So it was a pretty challenging experience, I'll say. And it was certainly disconcerting leaving the military with a great undergrad degree in aerospace engineering from the Naval Academy and just graduating from the top, was ranked number one in the country at Kellogg, and I couldn't even get interviews. It was crazy.
What was the work like while you were there? Like, what does strategy and operations work look like in that capacity?
So my first role was actually route and fleet planning for United. And one of the first things I was tasked with doing was building a fleet plan, which looked at what our growth was globally, market to market, and looking at the aircraft that we had. I think at the time it was about 600 aircraft, and looking at the capacity that each aircraft had and the utilization, and then figuring out how many we needed to bring in based on the routes that we were looking at adding going forward. So it was a pretty massive undertaking, and it was a lot of fun. We had a team of people that looked at all the routes, and we had one of us that was focused on the fleet. And so I would do a lot of analysis on different routes that we were looking at and the profitability of them, what we needed to price at in order to make some money, how many people we needed to capture in those markets as well. And then I ended up doing, I moved to the international side and focused on what today is the Star Alliance. We did the first analysis of the first international partners to look at between Lufthansa and Air France, and ended up selecting Lufthansa. And that started what is now the Star Alliance. That was really, really interesting. And because of that analytical background, I actually got recruited. I used to do something every day after lunch. This is one of the things I think in corporate America that, at least for me, was kind of eye-opening. I never got to understand what else was going on across the company. I was kind of in my own little cube and working very, very long days. I was working 16, 18-hour days at United. And so every day after lunch, I would just walk to a different part of the campus and introduce myself and just ask people what they do. And one of those conversations I struck up with a director that did all the planning for flight attendants for United. So from kind of large scale, how many do we need globally, to the details of how many are on each plane by cabin. That ended up turning into a job offer for me to come over and kind of update their forecasting system. They were using some pretty crude, rudimentary, kind of really almost back of the envelope planning at the time. And so I worked with our ops research team to build some linear programming techniques. And we did some really cool planning and forecasting around that.
I'm thinking back to that first transition for you, and what you're describing is probably not that unusual for some veterans where they get out and that first job is difficult. And it sounds like it was unexpected for you because you're coming, you know, basically from grad school, and that's not going to make the connections for you that you want. What advice do you have for people about that first job search, especially for those who don't go on to grad school and they're kind of starting from scratch? Any advice for them on how to like figure out what they want to do and figure out how to get that first job like you did at United?
You know, I think a lot of it comes down to trying to be aware of what you like to do, and don't be worried if the first job isn't the right job for you. I mean, I certainly in my career I've changed quite a bit, and you know, for me that part of that's due to growth. I like to learn. I like to find something new, new industries and everything else. I think that, you know, as you're attacking kind of the job search, doing it the same way, being open to things that maybe you haven't thought about before, and trying something new and different, having an awareness of what you're good at and what you like to do certainly helps. And, you know, I think that's easy to say. It's hard to do. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of books and things out there to try to help you to do that. I would say that, you know, I always knew I was analytical. I've always enjoyed that. So I was really kind of focused on doing that kind of a job search, very focused on, analytical roles. Ironically, I was not interested in consulting. I talked to a lot of people that had gone into consulting, and it just, at the time, it didn't seem like that would be a good fit for me. Obviously, that's changed quite a bit. But, you know, at the time, that was really my focus, was just getting out and talking to people. And I think the other thing, too, is trying to just being a good listener and trying to find out what people do in their jobs. Just go out and talk to people about what they do. Because I was always surprised. I would go out and talk to these executives and just ask a bunch of questions about, you know, so how did you get here, and what are the things that you did, and what do you like about it, what don't you like about it, you know. I learned a lot in those conversations, and I think that, you know, to the extent that people can do that and just go out and talk to people, you'll be surprised what you learn.
What was it that, you know, it sounds like you didn't initially think you would want to do consulting, and then that ends up becoming a big part of your career. Was that something that changed in you, or was there a misunderstanding of what that would be like, or what was the discrepancy there?
What I figured out about myself was that I really liked having to learn new things all the time. And that's kind of echoed in, that's why I do a lot of stuff with these startups. It keeps me learning. It keeps me fresh on technology and on some, you know, different trends. And I didn't appreciate that about consulting. I think that, you know, my understanding of it initially was that, you know, hey, you're building a team, you're going to go in, you're going to help this company solve a problem, and you're going to follow a process. And to me, that kind of sounded a little too rote, a little too boring. And as I got more and more exposed to it, I realized that, you know, the projects tend to be, depending on what kind of consulting you go into, but the projects tend to be, 3 to 6 months long. You're expected to get up to speed incredibly fast, and you just got to figure out, you know, what's going on and what the challenge is and how you're going to correct it. And I think that as I got more and more exposed to just day-to-day things, I found out that I really liked that. And I had an opportunity that presented itself, and that was my transition into consulting.
And what would you want people to know about your time at A.T. Kearney? What was that experience like, and what did you learn there?
So I actually went, when I left United, I got recruited to join a smaller boutique consulting firm called the Canning Group. It was a Booz Allen spinoff, and it was focused in aviation and aerospace, and specifically in strategy and market analysis. So I moved out to Park City, Utah for a few years where this firm was based, and we worked for A.T. Kearney on a large strategy project. And so, you know, I had been doing some work in the consulting world for about 2 years. And on this project, the leader of the project basically pulled me aside and just said, you know, man, I really enjoyed working with you. If you ever would consider coming to A.T. Kearney, I'd love to have you. And I found out at one point that the company was going to be sold in Park City, and they were going to move to Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And that just wasn't going to be something that was interesting to me. And I had this open offer, and so I called A.T. Kearney back up and just said, "Hey, is the offer still open?" And they said, "You know, yeah, come on over. Let's get you in the interview process." So I still had to go through the interview process and everything else, but in the end, obviously they made me the offer, and I joined them.
Mm. And then you were there for a little while before. What kind of brought you to Free Markets?
So on my second project at A.T. Kearney, we were doing some work with the company United Technologies, and we were being introduced to the executive team the same day as this little startup called Free Markets. And, you know, it was a very interesting concept. The idea was basically Free Markets created the reverse auction. So you would put suppliers into an auction environment, and they would bid for, in this case, United Technologies business. And they would watch, you know, the prices go down, right, which is hence the reverse auction. They were looking for somebody to work with, and they needed a first project. I was given about $100 million in commercial valves to go source. And so I went and traveled around the world finding suppliers that could do this. I had the market all set up and everything ready to go. Traditionally, you'd go into face-to-face negotiations, but we just didn't have enough time to get this done. Like, we only had 5 months to get this project done, and I had traveled around the world twice already talking to suppliers. And so I called the CEO of Free Markets, who actually was an Army officer and had gone to GE and then had this idea and started this business. And so I called him up and just said, you know, I've got this opportunity. I've got everything together. I'd love to use your process if you think it can work. And, you know, in great military sense, he said, "I'll be there tomorrow." and we sat down and got it all set up. And the long story short is we ran this auction and saved the client over $30 million in about 3 hours.
Unbelievable.
So that was a pretty powerful moment for me to understand what the potential was. And, you know, at that point, the CEO was saying, "Why don't you come join us? You know, this is going to be great. This, you know, we're growing like crazy." And at the time, they had 22 people. And I had just moved my family from Park City to Chicago with A.T. Kearney. And I just told them, "Man, you know, it's just not the right time. I can't do that to my family right now." And he said, "All right, well, if something changes, you know, let me know." And the UTC ended up not renewing the contract with A.T. Kearney, and they asked Free Markets to lead the way. And he said, "You know, well, we can do that, but we're going to need to build a team." And they said, "Great, start with Angeloni and McLeod."
Wow.
And so I got another phone call from the CEO, and this time it was a very attractive offer, and it was just too good to pass up. And so I joined with another gentleman from the A.T. Kearney team, who, ironically, was my co-founder at Tenzing as well.
How big were they when you joined them?
So I was employee 71. So they grew in the 6 months since I had been talking to them. They grew from 22 to 70. I joined in August, and by the end of the year, we were 105. They had about $1 million in revenue when I first joined. We finished that year with about $8 million. And then we grew that to $200 million in 3 years. We had about 1,200 people around the world. And I ran one of the lines of business. So we had, the business was basically organized by sector. And so I ran aerospace, defense, and government for us. And what an amazing ride. Absolutely incredible to see an organization grow that fast. And then to go public and deal with you know, the changes of becoming a public company. That's tough when you're used to being a private entity and all the fun that goes with the growth.
What was your life? I mean, it's helpful for listeners to kind of get a taste of what your life was like in this high growth startup environment. What was your life like? Were you traveling constantly? Like, what sort of activities were you doing? Just help them understand what a day in your life looked like in that period.
Yeah, so my role as a, you know, I started there running the United Technologies account, or a piece of it. And then as I grew there, moving into the general manager role, you know, then I had a lot of individuals working for me running accounts across our aerospace portfolio. The typical day, I mean, it's like any, I guess, executive type position where you're dealing with your customers and the things that are going on with them. You're dealing with your employees and the challenges that are going on there. You're kind of looking across the board at how to balance the needs of all these groups and the availability of resources. And, you know, these were long days. I mean, you know, I know that, you know, people like to talk about work-life balance. I'm probably a terrible person to talk to about that. I think, you know, I really enjoy the work. And I think that, you know, for me, the typical day was probably anywhere from 14 to 16 hours. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was, you know, there was a lot of meetings. There's a lot of travel. And I think it, I averaged probably about 150,000 miles a year flying those years. I've done more, but that's a lot of flying. And so I was, you know, I would travel all over the world to meet with my customers or prospective customers and talk to them about the services that we could offer and, you know, how we might structure something like that, negotiate with them on pricing and, you know, set up the agreements. So it's, you know, my role was kind of a, both a GM to run the business, but also, you know, sales support. And then like any leader, you're constantly balancing the needs of your team.
What is, just to put that in perspective, 150,000 miles in a year, like how often are you hopping on a plane at that point?
You know, it's almost every week. You know, to travel. I mean, I've done, when I was running the tech company in DC and commuting from Sonoma, I think my most miles I did that year was maybe 250,000. That was brutal. That was literally on a plane every week. And I don't advise that. But you know, I think that I still travel a lot. I mean, this year I think I did about 130,000. I'm closing in on 2 million miles with United. And I think I've got another almost million with other airlines. So I try not to think about how many hours I've spent in the air, but it's a long time. But you know, I think the needs of some of these companies, when you get to the point where you're running a global business, you know, you can do a lot more today than we could, you know, 10, 15 years ago, obviously, with Skype and video chat and whatever else you want to do. But there's just nothing like being, you know, face to face with somebody and solving, you know, solving something that they've got that's bothering them or is challenging them. And I think that's, you know, at least for the near term, that's likely to stay that way.
If someone is on active duty and it's their intention to get out and join a high growth startup, I mean, you really latched onto a rocket ship. What advice do you have for someone about how to find that high growth startup? And if that's possible to do that directly, or if there's something they need to do first, how can they go about that?
So I guess there's a couple thoughts there. You know, one is to put yourself in a position so that you can meet a bunch of people that are working in this area, right? So there's you know, pockets around the country of startup ecosystems, if you will. And so obviously Silicon Valley is you know, well known, but I think lesser known is, you know, Boston and New York. Indiana has a big startup community going. Denver, you know, there's quite a few others. So, you know, by positioning yourself in those areas and or being willing to locate there, I think that's, you know, number one. And then just start networking and talking to people that are working in some of these startups. There's all kinds of networking groups that that you can track down and join. There's usually a tech innovation group in these cities that is kind of set up for networking. I know when I was running the firm in D.C., we were part of a group there because it always helps to find employees that way. So, you know, I think one of the great things is that a company like that that's growing that fast almost creates a vacuum. And so they're always looking for great people. And I think the skills that you have coming out of the military are so strong for something like that, that I think people have finally figured that out now, that, you know, hey, you can take someone from the military, and even if they don't have the specific skill that you're looking for, you can teach them pretty quickly, and they'll be up to speed, and they'll be a phenomenal employee. And so I think that's really important. I think one comment I'll make, though, is that, you know, I've worked with well over 30 now. There's only a handful that have been successful. And I think the amount of luck that it takes to have the experience that I have, I didn't appreciate it at the time, right? I mean, I just thought this is what happened. I mean, that was my first startup. And I got really lucky. But as time goes on and as I work with others, you realize that not too many do that. And obviously, you know, the venture capital world has figured out that like 90% of companies fail. It's just something that I think you need to go into eyes wide open.
It's like almost having that expectation that like, hey, I'm going to join this startup, but there's, you know, high likelihood that in 12 months or 24 months, I'm out of a job because the company doesn't exist anymore. And if you're still willing to do that, then to go for it. But just, is that kind of the expectation to go in with?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, obviously you hope that's not the case. I think that, you know, looking at the market, looking at the team that's running the business, it certainly helps to try to mitigate some of that. But, you know, in the last downturn here in 2008 and 2009, I mean, I had to shut down two companies that I started and then like two or three other companies that I was an investor in, all got shut down in that period, like so many others around the country. And none of those were due to a failure of the business. It was basically, you know, things that you couldn't control. The market just disappeared. You know, people were trying to save their money and they weren't buying the things that they were buying before. Financing wasn't available any longer. And so, you know, stuff happens. So I think that, you know, if you're going to go that route, keep your burn rate low, your personal burn rate as low as you can. Put as much money away as you can so you've got some flexibility. And then go for it. I mean, it's a lot of fun. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not for everyone for sure, but if you have that risk profile, I think it's a great time. It's a lot of fun, and you'll learn a heck of a lot.
If someone listening is, you know, on a ship or plane or stationed somewhere right now, and they're on active duty, they like what you're saying. They've got that risk appetite. They've got some savings built up. What can they be doing now to prepare for that? Is there any books or resources or things that might help them start to get ready for that career as part of a startup?
You know, I think just doing some searches on the internet and looking for some of that. I don't have a specific book or blog or website that I'd recommend off the top of my head. I think the understanding the power of the network is really probably my biggest message to people on active duty. You know, work to build the network. Find a mentor that can help you kind of think through what you want to do and how you want to do it. And then if you have some ideas around locations that you might be interested in, you know, I would just do some searches for different tech groups and networking groups in those locations. And that, you know, that kind of preparation and work will be invaluable as you look to transition.
And so you're on the heels of this explosive growth at Free Markets. The company goes public, which, you know, so few companies do. What happens between that and then, you know, what is the genesis of starting your own consulting company?
So we hit a downturn like a lot of the businesses do. But in 2001, you know, had the dot-com bubble burst. What's interesting about Free Markets was that we actually had a business. You know, there was a lot of companies that went out and raised a bunch of money and on against an idea but didn't really have a business. We did a little bit different. We actually had a business and were making money, and we didn't go public until we actually were making money. But nonetheless, the downturn in 2001 came, and most of us that were on the service side of the business ended up seeing the writing on the wall. I mean, we needed to be a true tech business, and we were kind of a services business with a sexy tech back end, which was the auction itself. But we were in the process of transitioning a lot of that work into technology. And so during the downturn, everybody started to clamp down. A bunch of us left the company, and we were looking at, you know, what to do next. I was interviewing for like VP of strategy jobs and some different things. And then I got a call from a client at Alcoa, former client of mine. And they called and said, hey, you know, we're getting ready to kick off this huge initiative. I know you've done a bunch of these before. You know, would you be willing to come in and advise us? And I said, you know, how about 2 days a week? And they said, oh, that's great. We agreed on a rate. And, you know, pretty soon I was making more money working 2 days a week than I was full time before. And then Raytheon called me and said, hey, I heard you left. We've got all these problems down in Wichita. Could you go down and take a look? And so I ended up working 7 days a week to help prepare a board document for Raytheon, December 1st through 21st in 2001. And they called me back on the 22nd and said, the board presentation went great. When can you implement? And I just said, I'll get back to you. So I called this gentleman, Tom McLeod, who I had worked for at A.T. Kearney and then had worked for and with at Free Markets. And he had left Free Markets as well a little bit before me. And I just said, hey, I think I have a consulting firm, and I know I don't want to do this by myself, so what do you say? And in February of 2002, we signed the corporate documents to start Tenzing.
What was that like? Was it just the two of you kind of traveling to sites, or did you staff up, or how did you approach growing this consulting entity?
So it literally was a, you know, we call it our garage band. We literally started in my garage in Pittsburgh at the time. And we set up a little office there. When we set it up, we thought about what we might be able to do different than traditional management consulting firms, and where we thought we could do something that would bring little more value or value just in a different way. And we thought there's two things that maybe the traditional consulting model could be improved with. One was that when a new client comes to a consulting firm, they get whoever's available, not necessarily the best person for the job, you know, somebody that has specific industry expertise or functional expertise. And you know, consulting firms hire very bright people. They're going to get super smart people for sure, and they're going to come up to speed fast. But we thought, you know, maybe there's something to, you know, having someone with specific functional and industry expertise. And the second thing was that we wanted someone that could come in and really empathize with the client, someone that had sat in the chair, they've actually had, you know, their job or something very similar. So we liked this combination of consulting and industry expertise. And so we decided day one that we're going to have no employees. And as soon as we hire an employee, we felt like, you know, we're going to be an asset optimization engine. You know, we're going to be focused on how do we keep that person busy as opposed to really trying to find the right person for the job. And so we started 15 years ago with this idea of no employees, experts only. And we were going to staff a team, you know, it could be one person, it could be 10 people, depending on what the client's needs. And that was risky. We weren't sure if it was going to work, but people trusted us, and they trusted that we were only going to find, you know, the best and brightest. And so that's what we did. And you know, here we are, 15 years later. We have you know, over 850 experts around the world. We work with some of the top private equity firms in the world. And some of the top consulting firms in the world actually come to us for our expertise. And we have formal agreements with two of the top three strategy firms in the world. So, you know, it's really been a model that it's fairly acceptable today. I mean, if you think about kind of the gig economy and, you know, the Uber business model and other business models out there that are kind of this shared economy concept, we effectively have been doing that for 15 years now, and it's worked incredibly well.
And how does this work? Are these experts, are they employed elsewhere and they're like moonlighting and doing this, or is this a lot of like independent type contractors that will come in for periods of time, or what do these experts look like?
Yeah, they're all independent consultants. This is what they do full time. Now, full time for them may be, you know, some are partially retired and they like to do a project a year. Other people have designed their lifestyle to where they can make enough in 6 months that they can cover themselves for the entire year, and they work 6 months a year and that's it. We've got one gentleman that actually just moved back to Italy, but he used to take every summer off and go to Italy, and just he'd work the rest of the year and then take the summer off. So these individuals typically have their own relationships with former clients, but also work with networks like ours, and that's kind of their deal flow. These are all hand-picked individuals, you know, by Tom and myself. So, you know, we like people that like to get their hands dirty. Actually, the story behind the name Tenzing comes from the way that Tom and I originally thought about how we wanted to work. You know, we both like to get our hands dirty. We both like to jump in and actually do the work. And in a traditional consulting firm, you know, once you get to partner level, I mean, you're just not doing that anymore. So we thought about, you know, well, okay, so we've got very senior experienced people that are helping our clients kind of achieve their goals and objectives, but doing it in kind of an egoless way and letting our clients take the credit. And we just thought that sounded a lot like a Sherpa, you know, that helps people get to the top of the mountain, and the most famous Sherpa being Tenzing Norgay, who helped Sir Edmund Hillary get to the top of Everest for the first time. And so we actually reached out to Tenzing's family, and his son, turns out Norbu, lives in San Francisco. And so we told him why we'd like to use his father's name and asked permission to do so, and he just said, you know what, I think my dad would be really honored, and you know, absolutely, you can use the name. So, you know, it goes all the way back to the DNA of the founding of Tenzing on the type of people that we like to hire and the type of people that we like to work with. And that's really why, you know, our clients continue to ask us to come back and help. It's a very different model.
I mean, you must have this amazing mental Rolodex of when you're talking to a client. I just imagine as they're describing a problem, you're just flipping through in your mind all of these different people and who would be the right tool for their specific need. Is that pretty accurate? Is that kind of your primary role now, is finding the optimum solution, the optimum person to help out a client on their unique need?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I just was on a call just before this with a client that we worked at before.
He reached out, had a very, very specific, narrow need. We have a woman that runs our expert network now, and she manages it for us. We do have a CRM system that we use now, thank God, because I can't remember 850 people, at least not at the detail that we need. And as they gain more more experience, you know, as well, we keep up, you know, our notes on the different things that they've learned. But, you know, typically that is something that Tom and I will do, and we'll get together with some of our other consultants that we might have on a project, and we'll kind of, you know, spitball. All right, so this is what they need. Who do we know that has this? We'll come up with a handful of people off the top of our head, but then we'll actually go do the work of getting to the CRM and looking at who else might be out there. So we will source the best people, you know, for the job, and it's really fun. It's really, really interesting.
One thing I want to ask about is networking. I mean, it sounds like throughout your story, networking has played a big role in your finding opportunities. And it sounds like, you know, that's something that has built Tenzing up, is the ability to network and add to this expert grid of people. And I know, you know, in talking to a lot of veterans, a lot of them have difficulty with it. They perceive it as something that's slimy or something that is just off-putting for them. How would you explain networking to someone on active duty, and any advice on how they would approach it in a way that will be both authentic for them but also be effective?
You know, it's a great question, because I was certainly really intimidated by it when I was leaving, because the terminology was different. The vocabulary, you know, I was afraid of asking stupid questions. But in the end, I kind of got over it and just realized that I was going to have to do that to learn. And I think that's, you know, my big message to them is, you know, it's okay. People don't expect you to have all the answers and to know everything. I mean, you're coming out of one career. They certainly don't understand your vocabulary. And so, you know, what I did was, I networked into different groups that were working in industries I thought might be interesting. And I just invited someone to lunch or breakfast or over a coffee, and just sat down and talked to them and asked them, you know, a bunch of questions. And I just prefaced it, you know, very simply that, hey, I'm getting ready to transition out of the military. I'm not really sure what I want to do yet, but I'd like to learn more about, you know, your industry and maybe your career. You know, would you be willing to get together and just talk about that? And I mean, no one turned me down. Everybody said, ah, sure, absolutely. And I just learned a lot about, you know, what people did and kind of, you know, their career path and what they liked and didn't like. And I think, you know, that's okay. It's okay to go in there and ask, you know, a lot of questions and just try to learn as much as you can about an industry, a job, whatever it might be.
That's great. And I know we've only got a little bit of time left here, but I'm curious, what would you want listeners to know from that time? You took a step back from Tenzing, and you were involved in various startups. What would you want people to know about that experience or what you learned from that?
You know, it's back to your network comment. It's 2 years after starting Tenzing, I got a call from an executive that had taken a new board position at a company, and he asked me to come in and take a look at the board documents, because it was a tech company, it was a joint venture between Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, Rolls-Royce, and BAE Systems. They had put $100 million into this business, and this guy just, he didn't know anything about the business. He didn't know, you know, anything about the area that they worked. And he says, you know, he called me and just said, look, Bill, I know this space incredibly well. And you've done stuff with tech companies. You know, would you come in and just take a look and kind of give me your assessment on the things I need to think about as a new board member? And so I did that. And a year later, he called me and said, hey, we're firing the CEO tomorrow. I'd like to put you forth as a candidate. You know, what do you say? And I was kind of taken aback. I had literally just moved into my house in Sonoma 5 days before. And this company's in D.C. And I just said, well, you know, I'm not going to pick up and move. My family's used to me traveling. If the board's okay with that, you know, go ahead and put me in. And so, you know, obviously I ended up getting getting the offer to be the CEO there, and we did a turnaround of that company, which was just really a lot of fun. It was really, really interesting. And so we grew 60% that first year and made money for the first time ever, and then we continued to grow over the next couple years. And, you know, I think that that time was really interesting to me. I gained a lot of experience. But, you know, I also gained some experience working with boards and realizing that that's a real challenging dynamic. And in this case, my board completely changed over 3 years. The board that brought me in had one strategy and one thing that they wanted me to achieve, which was turn around the company and then, you know, move on. They wanted to sell it. The new board that came in, they said, well, wait a minute, you know, this is now critical infrastructure. We probably don't want to sell this. And so after 3 years, we basically agreed to disagree, and I moved on and started another business. I had been looking into renewable energy and put together an incredible team of people that were passionate about that space, and we raised some money, raised about $3 million, and built that company up. Had to shut that down in 2009 when the downturn hit, unfortunately. And then I got a call from another former colleague who had an idea and basically said, look, you know, I've got a guy running the business, but I need someone that can really lead sales for me and help me build this business. And it was a tech business that created markets around working capital. So it basically took invoices due to suppliers and presented them through the software to the supplier to where they could get paid early. Guaranteed in 48 hours if they offered a discount, and we basically settled that in an auction setting once a week, and that business now just raised $50 million I think a year ago. It's got about an $800 million valuation right now, so that one's going great. But I was ready at the end of that to get back to consulting. I'd been missing it, and I was ready to step back in the ring, and so January 1st of 2012, I returned to Tenzing. Been a wild ride there ever since. We've had our best year ever this year. We've been growing like crazy the last few years. We just made it on Inc. 5000 again for the second time. So it's been a lot of fun.
It's pretty, you've got just such a unique story in terms of just the diversity of things that you've done and just kind of hopping from one thing to the next and just kind of always being active in the air or on land, depending on where you're caught. And I know we're almost out of time, but I always want to reserve the last question to be open-ended. And that's just, what have we not talked about that you would want to share with a veteran or someone on active duty who's listening to this?
You know, I think we've really, really hit it. To me, the biggest thing I can stress is building a network. You know, it's just shocking to me how many opportunities have come to me through friends and colleagues or people that have just, you know, heard about me through someone that they knew and have reached out and asked for advice. And, you know, I think something that I try to do quite a bit of is just helping people in their careers. I think it's, you know, it's great to just be able to talk to somebody, whether they're active duty and transitioning, or if they're, you know, my daughter's in finishing college, if it's one of her friends just thinking about something, just to try to help talk to people about, you know, different things they can do. And it always comes back to you. You know, it's like, you know, we talk about with Tenzing, we talk about the karma of, you know, you help somebody out over here and then something comes back, you know, somewhere else where a client calls and just said, hey, so-and-so told me that I should call you. And so I think, you know, it can be off-putting. It could be awkward, maybe initially, but it doesn't have to be. And, you know, the idea of building a network, certainly LinkedIn today makes it a lot easier. You can certainly visualize your network a lot more than you used to be able to, but it's incredibly important. And, you know, also just from a career standpoint, I mean, we've talked about, I mean, I've been all over the place, you know, and that's okay. There isn't one straight path to a career, and there certainly isn't a definition for a career. I mean, I think a long time ago it was, you know, you went to one company and you worked there for 20 years. I think today it is what you want it to be. And with technology and the flexibility that's in the market, you can do a lot of different things and that will define, you know, you as a person and you as your career in ways that you just couldn't do even 10 years ago. So I think that's super exciting. Mm.
Well, this is great, Bill. I appreciate your sharing your story with us and for all the advice.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. And, you know, I think anybody that's out there that's getting ready for this transition, you know, it's so much fun. It's going to be stressful, but it's so much fun.
Surface. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Bill today. I hope you enjoyed the variety he has in his career and just the enthusiasm he brings to it. He does not seem to be a man who likes to be idle, and it's pretty fun to hear about his gallivanting around the world on different exploits. If you have liked this show, please share it with others. Please leave us a good review on iTunes. Definitely help spread the word about what I'm doing with Beyond the Uniform. If you have ideas for other shows or recommendations on things that would better serve the veteran community, feel free to drop me a note at justin@beyondtheuniform.io or leave a comment in the show notes. Have a great week, and I will be back next week with more stories with military veterans about their civilian career.